Welcome to Indie Film Weekly, a No Film School podcast. I'm Liz Nord, editor-in-chief of No Film School.
And I'm Emily Buder, managing editor of No Film School.
It's May 25th, 2016. On this week's show, Emily's going to bring us a full report from the Cannes Film Festival, and we've got some other news from Europe, including Netflix quotas and a Herzog masterclass. And as always, news you can use about gear, upcoming deadlines, new film releases, and Ask No Film School. Welcome to this week's show. As always, we're coming at you from downtown Brooklyn, New York. We're here to bring you everything you might have missed while you were busy making films. Ryan Koo, our founder and my usual co-host, is still out. He's been working 100 plus hour weeks in pre-production for his film Amateur. And I'm sure many of you know that when you're in that mode, you can barely even check in. So we're still rooting for you, Ryan, and we miss you. And that also means that this week I am joined, as you've heard, by Emily Buder, who is fresh off the red carpet from Cannes, and I cannot wait to hear about it. Welcome back, Emily. We missed you so much.
Thank you so much. It feels good to be back. It was definitely a whirlwind. This was my first Cannes, and I saw 12 movies in 7 days.
Wow.
Yes. And that was in between interviews, press conferences, and supposedly eating.
Well, I hope you at least got like a good croissant in there or something.
Oh, definitely. You can't miss that.
So tell us about it. As we mentioned on last week's show, this was the first time No Film School has ever had a reporter there, and none of us on the team have been there either. So we want to hear all about it, and I'm sure our listeners do too.
Okay, well, I can start by telling you what did and didn't match my expectations. First and foremost, it was very crowded there. The main headquarters of Cannes is the Palais, and that is a complex of theaters, and it also includes the Marché du Film, which is a giant marketplace.
It seems appropriate that at a festival as fancy as Cannes is supposed to be, that the main venue would be called the Palais, the palace.
Yes. So outside the venue, there is this strip along the beach called the Croisette, which is literally the coastline of international cinema, and it's spotted with hotels where each distribution company sets up camp, and some of them have an entire floor. They host different parties and host interviews for the films that they're bringing to the festival and host meetings. So it's kind of set up where the Palais is the epicenter, and then the Croisette is a long stretch of beach.
So do you like bump into celebrities while you're like pushing your way through the Croisette?
Not really. The celebrities come and go. It's not quite the... In fact, it was a lot more segregated in terms of economic inequality than I thought it would be. It was way more glamorous. It was kind of ruled by the 1%. Each distribution company has either a hotel or a yacht or both, and they host really expensive, ostentatious parties on yachts. And you really need to be cool enough to get invited to them. And I wasn't.
But I heard you got a top-notch badge.
That's true. I was able to go into screenings at the last minute, which was really helpful for my schedule.
Yeah, I mean, it really surprises me because you see the pictures and you see all this kind of like quote-unquote controversy in the press about such and such didn't wear heels on the red carpet and what a scandal it was. But it just seems so at odds with my own festival experience. I've been to festivals all over the world, just not Cannes. And it's usually like pretty chill, ranging from South by Southwest, where it's like, if you're not wearing a flannel, then, you know, you're overdressed, to like Tribeca, which is kind of fancy, but you can still get away with jeans, even at like premiere screenings. So it's hard for me to picture this like fancy festival. Did you have to dress up?
Well, in order to even attend a screening in the biggest theater there called the Grand Lumiere, you have to be wearing a ball gown. So there's a dress code for that theater.
Oh my God.
Thankfully, that's not where the press screenings were located. It's a glamour festival. It's first and foremost a glamour festival. And that was very surprising to me. Another thing that was surprising was that there were way fewer Americans than I expected there to be. For some reason, I had this preconceived notion that Hollywood would have a bigger presence at the festival. But there were really only two big Hollywood movies there: Money Monster, Jodie Foster's movie, and The BFG, Steven Spielberg's movie. And there's a little bit of fanfare around those movies. But other than that, it's truly an international festival. You could go hours without running into an American. And I would be put on interview roundtables where there was somebody from Kurdistan, someone from Serbia. It was really energizing to be around international cinema, which seems to have, I don't know, it seems to have a more exciting pulse than Hollywood can.
Mm. And the festival is not just a film festival, right? It's a whole like international market.
The one area that I was least familiar with going into the festival was the marketplace, which is called the Marché du Film, which means film market in French. Early on in the festival, I actually ran into a producer from Nashville who told me that 80% of worldwide cinema deals go down at the Cannes marketplace.
Wow. So even much more than Sundance.
Yeah, absolutely. It's that section of the festival, the Marché, is actually more like a convention than it is something that you would think would exist in a film festival. It's comprised of rooms upon rooms upon rooms, all of them set up in a labyrinthine fashion so you can get completely lost in it. Each distributor has a booth, which start at about $5,000 to rent. And you can pay $300 for a market badge and not even go to Cannes to see movies. You can just go for the marketplace and take meetings. When I was wandering through the marketplace, I was stopping at each booth to ask people questions, and I would get 5 minutes into a conversation with somebody and they would get ushered aside for a meeting. And it seemed like it was, you know, literally back to back to back meetings at that marketplace.
So everybody does it has seem like independent producers who don't necessarily have like an international rep or sales agent do have the opportunity to get these meetings if they buy the badge?
Well, yes and no. You really want to go to the market with a goal. That's what I kept hearing. You want to have a film to sell. You want to have a company to promote. You can wander sort of aimlessly and try to meet people, but everybody is so busy and has such an agenda that it would really behoove you to go in with an agenda yourself.
Right.
There were 3,450 projects being offered at the marketplace this year.
And holy cow.
The marketplace also hosts screenings, and in that same area is where the International Pavilion is. Each country's film commission can set up shop to tell you about their tax incentives or co-production opportunities that are specific to their country.
So it seems like a pretty worthwhile experience for like a kind of a hungry producer who's willing to really hit the pavement.
Yeah, actually, I was staying with somebody who was participating in the producer's workshop, which is another big subsection of the festival. You have to get nominated for it, and he had been nominated. His impressions of it were that it really opened his eyes to how many films are getting made around the world. And the fact that there's a treaty system in Europe, which I think a lot of American producers are not aware of. Many countries have treaties for film productions that basically set a legal framework for working together. And since America doesn't have these treaties in place, a lot of American producers are forced to create co-ventures, which are essentially just business agreements, and they're not legally supportable.
So before we get to the most important part, which of course is movies, are there any other kind of impressions or things you saw or things that people who haven't been to Cannes should know about?
Yeah, another big presence at the festival this year were the second annual Women in Motion talks. That was headlined by Juliette Binoche and Susan Sarandon and Jodie Foster, all of whom gave really interesting press conferences and speeches about their perspective on women in film. At those talks, Susan Sarandon actually stirred up a bit of controversy when she slammed Woody Allen for his child abuse allegations. Woody Allen was actually at the festival this year opening Cannes with his film Café Society. At the first press conference of the festival, Woody Allen actually said some very interesting things about the inherent value of competition. One of the first quotes to go on record at the festival this year was him saying, "I don't believe in competition for artistic things. It's great in sports, that's the objective, but film is all very subjective." And he is sort of infamous for keeping his films out of competition when he premieres them there. The jury this year was led by George Miller, who said, "Well, for me, the fact that a movie is in competition is balanced by the opportunity to see new films with this incredibly talented group of people." On the jury this year, it was Arnaud Despletchin, Kirsten Dunst, Valerina Golino, Mads Mikkelsen, Laszlo Nemes, Vanessa Paradis, Kadayoun Shahabi, and Donald Sutherland.
Listen, I commend both of them. I commend Susan Sarandon for speaking out against alleged child abuse. And I commend Woody Allen for saying, you know, maybe competition isn't appropriate for films. On the other hand, it's easy for someone to, you know, eschew competition who's already widely recognized and rich. I mean, competition can be an amazing way for an up-and-coming indie filmmaker to get recognition and get some cash and launch their careers. So, you know, I'm on the fence about that one. Did you see any of the award-winning films this year?
Yeah, actually, one of my favorites was the Palme d'Or winning film. It was by the 80-year-old Ken Loach, a British filmmaker, and the film was called I, Daniel Blake. So the film was incredibly interesting because it was very political. It was a neorealist film about an aging carpenter fighting for welfare benefits after he has a very serious heart attack. And he kind of gets a Kafka-esque run around by the British welfare system, trying to find money to support himself. And he's a very hardworking, decent man. He just keeps coming up against obstacle after obstacle. And there's actually, I wrote an article about the film, and it includes quotes from the press conference where it was basically a political discussion about how Britain is facing a major vote next month that could result in its secession from the European Union, and that's particularly relevant with regard to this film.
Seems like a lot of the films, by the way, I really enjoyed reading your posts and your interviews and articles, and you all out there should be checking out nofilmschool.com for Emily's many interviews from Cannes, but it seemed like several of the films had some political bent this year. What were some of the others that you saw and enjoyed?
One of the most interesting films that I saw this year was actually in the Uncertain Regard section, which is in competition but not part of the main competition. And they tend to feature first-time directors or people doing more experimental takes on different worldwide subject matter. This one was by an Egyptian director named Mohamed Diab. It was set after the ousting of the Egyptian president, Mohamed Morsi. So the political unrest was between Muslim Brotherhood supporters and anti-Muslim Brotherhood Egyptians. The entire film takes place in the back of a 20-foot truck, a police van, as it's moving through these incredibly violent protests throughout the city of Cairo. And the film doesn't take sides. It presents each side with the same amount of humanity, and I thought that was an incredibly noble and interesting take on the subject matter. I actually got to speak with the producer, Mohamed Hefsi, who talked a little bit about what it was like shooting in the back of a 20-foot truck in a confined space.
In the middle of, like, an active protest zone, or?
Well, it was interesting because they staged the protests, but mm-hmm. there isn't really a stunt culture in Egypt, and they hired a stunt coordinator, but there wasn't a lot of infrastructure. So essentially, those were not very controlled stunts.
So the stunts were kind of real.
Yes, essentially, yes. Also, the film had to be approved by a censor before it could even get made. And so that's just an interesting element of the process. Another film that dealt with religious fanaticism was a Russian film by Kirill Serebrennikov called The Student. It was adapted from a play, and it was very reminiscent of a tragic Russian play with, you know, three very concrete acts. It was about a young boy who starts interpreting the Bible literally and sort of forcing everybody in his world to conform to these literal interpretations. It exposes the conservatism of the Russian education system and Russian society. The cinematography was amazing, and I spoke to the director at the festival too, who talked about the new generation of Russian producers all being very brave and willing to sort of topple the system.
So it really is international. I mean, so far we've had an Egyptian film, Russian film, what else?
Another film that actually won the Best Screenplay Award in the Uncertain Regard section was made by two French sisters, Delphine and Muriel Colline. Muriel was a DP who went to film school, and Delphine was a novelist, and the two co-direct completely equally. The film was about two female French soldiers returning from a tour in Afghanistan, and on the way home, they stop in Cyprus for a so-called decompression period, where they're supposed to relive their memories from war through 3D virtual reality projections. And the filmmakers actually cast five real soldiers in the film, which is something they told me in an interview I did with them. So there were a lot of layers of truth going on in that film.
It sounds like a range of intense subjects.
Yes.
Do you think you are you far enough away from the festival to have like chosen a festival favorite?
You know, the critical favorite, which actually, interestingly enough, did not get a single award, was this film by a German director, Marin Ade, called Toni Erdmann. This was one of the most enjoyable films of the festival because even though it was by structure a drama, it was incredibly comedic and absurd. It's about a father and daughter who are basically playing a cat and mouse game. They're estranged and they're trying to reconnect. And the father does so by injecting himself into her life by all of these elaborate practical jokes. He cares more about trying to show her that she may not be living a very meaningful, enjoyable life than he does about sort of throwing her off the course of the corporate ladder that she's desperately trying to climb. And it's interesting because the director, when I spoke to her at the festival, mentioned how on set she shot the film like a sad movie. And they focused a lot on the more serious and dramatic elements, so much that a lot of people on set didn't really realize it was a comedy until the comedy came together in editing. And out of the festival, people are touting it as a comedy. So it's just interesting how that can happen.
Hmm.
Another festival favorite, which sadly didn't get any awards except for one very important one, which I'll mention in a little bit, is Jim Jarmusch's Patterson, which starred Adam Driver as a bus driver named Patterson, follow this very closely, who lives in Patterson, New Jersey. And Patterson is a very poetic film. It's sort of an ode to poetry and life and the poetry of life. It's very simple and elegant, and it takes us through Adam Driver's routine, which is essentially just wake up, drive bus, come home, spend time with girlfriend, and take the dog for a walk. And when I spoke to the producers of Patterson at Cannes, they spoke about one of the biggest production challenges actually being finding this dog, which is named Nellie, and she won the Palm Dog, which is a riff on the Palme d'Or. She's an English bulldog, and she's very cute, and she vocalizes a lot.
Are there dogs in the festival every year, like enough that they can actually do this Palm Dog Award every year?
Last year, it was White God. Did you see that?
No.
Oh, okay. That was about, it definitely starred a dog actor. The acting was incredible.
So I guess not everything at Cannes takes itself overly seriously.
That's very true.
So overall impressions, final thoughts?
So true to European form, there were definitely a lot of long movies in the festival. I think the average runtime was just over 2 hours, but many of them were actually closer to 3 hours. And the experience of watching these films was really interesting because towards the end of the third act, you would find yourself bracing for multiple fake-out endings. So you would kind of look back on films and think, like, the film could have ended here and everything would have been great, but yet it continued, and then it continued, and then it continued. And it kind of got me thinking about, well, first of all, where did all the editors go? Because the editor's job is to make sure that doesn't happen.
Where have all the editors gone?
And I don't know. There's something to be said for keeping an entire world and all of the lives within that world in an hour and a half runtime. At the festival, Marin Audit, who was one of the worst perpetrators of this because Toni Erdmann was almost 3 hours long, talked about how she tried everything to shorten the film, but it lost its complexity. And I wasn't so sure how that argument held up.
Well, you said it was one of the most enjoyable, but you still would have shaved a...
I would have shaved a good half an hour off of it.
Wow.
Yeah. Another thing that I wasn't quite expecting was that movies at Cannes can be really divisive, and everybody has a very, very, very strong opinion about a film. And they have the opinion seemingly fully formed as soon as they walk out of the screening. There's not a lot of buffer time for processing it. So oftentimes I would walk out of a screening, like, for example, Olivier Assayas's Personal Shopper, which I personally thought was half-baked and did not love. But as soon as I walked out of the theater, people started you know, professing their love for it, critics that I really, really respected. And I started to wonder if I'd actually seen the same movie as them 5 minutes ago. So it was an interesting experience in that regard, too.
So it's a little different from like the States, where we have this kind of political correctness thing where people kind of keep their opinions to themselves. Like there, people were just kind of
outspoken,
letting it all out. Wow.
Yes, definitely. And it's great because it encourages debate, but it also has, it has a downside because it makes you jump to conclusions about films rather than doing what movies should do, which is marinate over the course of the, you know, the next 24 hours as you think about your own life and the larger implications of the movie.
Right. And I guess if a bunch of press are seeing the film together at press screenings, you know, someone could really poison the well for filmmakers by like loudly professing their dislike for a film around a bunch of other press.
It's
Although
true.
It could work the other way too, so you never know.
It's true. But it did seem like this year there it was evenly divided between lovers and haters of each movie.
Oh, so it works out in
a
the
mixed
end.
Mixed bag.
Well, thank you so much for going there and, you know, braving the French crowds, the attractive, I'm sure, French crowds, and, you know, whipping out your heels and all of that. We the coverage was really, really interesting, and there's more to come, I know, this week. So all of you out there, I encourage you to go to nofilmschool.com. The post associated with this podcast will have links to all of Emily's interviews and articles from Cannes.
Thank you so much. It was an incredible experience. I couldn't believe I was there half of the time.
We have some other news coming out of Europe this week for our European listeners and also cinephiles who love their work. The European Commission has announced a new proposal that will require streaming services like Netflix and Amazon Prime to devote at least 20% of their libraries to European content. So Netflix commented on a draft of the proposal, and they said that quotas would encourage streaming companies to purchase lower quality titles to meet the requirements. But I'm thinking maybe this is a boon to indies, like not that indies are lower quality, but if Netflix and Amazon have to purchase more foreign titles and they want to purchase cheaper foreign titles, maybe they'll purchase more indies because indies are less expensive than mainstream titles. So we'll have to see. And the other thing we'll have to see, I don't understand how the EU could actually enforce these regulations. Like how could the European Union make Netflix purchase a certain, you know, number of titles? But it's interesting. We'll see what happens. And in kind of funny, kind of amazing, very European news, Werner Herzog is apparently offering an online filmmaking class through the website Masterclass. It's going to be only $90. It offers 5 hours of lessons, a class workbook with supplemental materials. And this is the craziest part, office hours that let you upload your videos and receive feedback from other classmates and potentially Herzog himself. He's going to choose some videos to give critical feedback on. So the course is going to run this summer. You can pre-enroll now. I'm kind of in shock about the whole thing. Like,
it sounds like a surreal experience.
I mean, it also doesn't sound like a very Herzogian thing to do. Like, I would think he somehow would find computers offensive. I don't know.
Well, he's coming out with that doc about technology. I think it comes out earlier in the fall this year. So he's got a handle on technology.
Wow. I mean, just to hear his accent for those 5 hours of videos, I'm into it. Masterclass is also offering acting classes with Dustin Hoffman and Kevin Spacey. So this is an up-and-coming company. I think it seems like they're doing some interesting things. I, for one, I'm excited to take Herzog's class.
Yeah, I want to hear him wax poetic forever.
We have an update from last week's show, more from the digital space. We talked about Amazon's Video Direct service. And actually, since then, just yesterday, we put up an in-depth piece from filmmaker Nikhil Kamkolkar, who made Indian Cowboy, about why he chose Amazon to self-distribute his feature. And it's got a whole bunch of sort of info about the steps that he went through in looking at Vimeo and YouTube and VHX and others, and ended up on Amazon, and he gives you kind of a step-by-step guide for what you need to do to upload your film to the service. And so definitely check that out. And I also look forward to kind of following up with Nikhil in, you know, the coming months to see, is he making any money? How's it working out? But, you know, the landscape is changing very, very quickly for self-distribution. And in more gear news, for you drone heads, DJI is updating its iOS app this week to allow owners of its Phantom and Inspire drones to stream aerial footage live to Facebook. So most of you probably know, if you're already flying drones, you can already stream to YouTube, but Facebook is obviously more personal and direct and could be a real game changer for lots of different kinds of things. creepy on the spying front. Like, now not only can someone spy on you with a drone, but they could stream that spying direct to Facebook. I guess that's, you know, me revealing my own personal bias. But, you know, it's exciting because it really means that drones aren't going away. And there's sort of more filmmaking possibilities. And in general, the possibilities of streaming live to the web, I think, offer some creative opportunities. There's going to be an Android version of the app in the near future. We don't know when yet. We also mentioned on last week's show that Google and GoPro would begin shipping the Odyssey, which is a 16-camera VR rig. And then since then, they held their annual I/O conference where they announced details of Daydream, which is a VR hardware and software system powered by Android. So that means they're not only working on the production side of VR with the Odyssey, but also on the distribution side now with this Daydream. They already released the Google Cardboard a couple years ago. That's that disposable headset that you could like slip a phone into and watch VR. And this is like the next level. Daydream's the next level of that. It's basically, it works only with specially enabled Android phones. So you have to buy the headset and you have to buy the phone. But it has a whole slate of apps associated with it. And I think that's where it kind of becomes interesting for filmmakers, because they have partnerships for the new product with Netflix and IMAX and other media distributors. So filmmakers that have been playing with VR and 360 filmmaking will have now potentially more outlets for the work to be shown. And I think a lot of filmmakers and people who've commented on our boards and on the show have said, you know, what's all this talk about VR? Like, why would I even make a VR 360 film if nobody can watch it? And listen, if Google's getting in on the game as far as both production and distribution of VR, then, you know, it's probably a pretty safe bet that, like, it's a real thing and not just a gimmick. There are some deadlines this week for some really great opportunities. One is the Points North Fellowship. The early deadline is May 27th. This is from our friends at the Camden International Film Festival, a really great, dedicated group of people. The Points North Documentary Forum is 3 days of workshops, meetings, pitch sessions, masterclasses that basically help documentary filmmakers advance their projects. It happens at the same time as the Camden International Film Festival in beautiful Camden, Maine in September. But this Points North Fellowship invites 6 filmmakers to attend the forum and basically accelerate the development of their documentary project. So you have to be working on a feature-length documentary. But if you get the fellowship, you're invited to be part of the forum. You get a $2,000 grant. You have all-access passes to the festival, 5 nights of accommodation for 2, a round-trip flight to Maine, tickets to the Cinema Eye Honors in January in New York, plus accommodations in New York.
That's a great deal.
It's such a great opportunity. And again, it's offered by people who really, really care, I think, about the projects that they take on and about the craft of filmmaking and about filmmakers. So I highly recommend that you apply. Again, the early deadline's May 27th, and they've actually have an extended deadline in July, but I think it's $20 cheaper to apply if you do so early. So go for it.
There's also a new residency called Cinephilia, which has a deadline on May 31st. And it's geared toward career and emerging screenwriters and film directors from the Middle East and North Africa. It's a 2-week residency in New York with free accommodation and partial travel costs. And it comes with all sorts of opportunities to engage in the New York film community, like one-on-one sessions with professional script consultants. You must be over 25 and in development on your first, second, or third feature film to apply.
Yeah, I think they accept narrative and docs, right?
Oh, yes, they do.
So Emily had actually called it Documentary Week on the site yesterday because we have a few posts up specifically for doc makers, including some details of 4 rolling grant deadlines that you can apply for right now. And it's a good time of year to do so since there aren't a lot of other major grant deadlines looming. So these ones that have rolling deadlines, you know, you can apply to anytime. As John said, any season is rolling grant deadline season. We posted about some for U.S. and international documentarians, the Sundance Documentary Fund, the Catapult Film Fund, the Ford Foundation Just Films, and for those documentarians in New York City, the Jerome Foundation. As usual, you can get links to all these opportunities on the post associated with this podcast.
We're coming up on some really great festival deadlines, too, the first of which is on May 27th. It's the San Diego Asian Film Festival. And it's actually the largest and longest running Asian film festival in America, 17 years and counting. We've also got the New Jersey Film Festival, whose deadline is May 30th. It's exactly what it sounds like, the New Jersey Film Festival. And it takes place between September 18th and October 16th of this year.
It's always worth noting festivals that have prizes, and this New Jersey Film Festival has prizes in animation, documentary, experimental, short, narrative, feature, student video maker, so worth applying to potentially get a prize. And I was surprised to learn that it's the 35th year of the festival. We're so New York focused here in New York, and we have so many of our own film festivals that, you know, we don't always look right across the river. I'm glad we're giving them a little love today on the show. The Boston Jewish Film Festival has an entry deadline on May 31st, and I was actually in this festival with my film Jericho's Echo. They are so lovely. They treat filmmakers really well, and you get to have your film screened in one of my favorite national theaters, the Coolidge Corner Theater. It's a 28-year-old festival. It's one of the largest and longest-running Jewish film festivals in the world, and it premieres what they call the best of contemporary cinema on Jewish themes from around the world. And for you bros out there, May 31st is the extended deadline for the Coachella Valley International Film Festival, bro. It's going to be the first ever edition of this outdoor two-day festival under the stars in Coachella.
And they pay special attention to ultra-low budget films. So if that's your arena, this is a good one to apply to.
Yeah, they also have prizes in a whole bunch of film and screenplay categories, including low budget, micro budget, and no budget features, which is rare. In movie openings this weekend and next week, I actually have to admit I have not seen any of these, so I've got to put them all in my queue. On VOD May 31st, Barge will be released. It was the South by Southwest Vision standout last year. It's a documentary by Ben Powell about barge workers.
Over on Amazon Prime Instant, on June 1st, Apocalypse Now and Apocalypse Now Redux will be added to the Instant catalog.
There's a long, long Redux version, 195 minutes long, and I think it's worth mentioning on the show, again, not because it's an indie, but because there are so many lessons that indie makers can learn from watching these, you know, absolute pillars of American cinema. The Rooftop Films opening film from last year, Seven Chinese Brothers with Jason Schwartzman, is coming out on June 1st on Netflix.
Also coming to Netflix this week is Cold in July, which is a majorly underappreciated indie revenge thriller from 2015, starring Michael C. Hall, Sam Shepard, and Don Johnson. It's sort of reminiscent of Blue Ruin, if you've seen that, but it's a little different, and it's worth seeing.
It's a great week for indies on Netflix. Also on June 1st, Meadowland is being released. That was directed and shot by my fellow film fatale, Reed Morano. It was a popular indie starring Olivia Wilde, who gives a career-defining role as a woman losing her mind.
And finally, also coming to Netflix is Rock the Casbah, which is Bill Murray's latest critical flop. although I would see any movie with Bill Murray in it, and that was something I put to the test with his Christmas special, which was, I enjoyed because it was Bill Murray-centric, but it was terrible.
I didn't even know about it.
Oh, Sofia Coppola directed it, and yeah, it shouldn't have been made, but I'm glad I saw it. As far as theatrical openings, a very interesting Sundance doc favorite from this year called Holy Hell is opening. The documentarian actually embedded himself in a cult for over 20 years.
Yeah, that one actually kicked off the Rooftop Films feature film program this year. And now for our lovely Ask No Film School segment. We choose these questions from the No Film School boards. And one very demanding questioner this week asked us to tell her the principles of composition. This was Victoria Michael. So just out of curiosity, I searched composition on our site. And, you know, by way of a plug, you get over 500 posts. So composition is well-defined in many ways right on No Film School. And I encourage you, Victoria, and the rest of you to check it out. There's posts ranging from focal elements to Fibonacci, a 30-minute in-depth study of composition, to composition and framing can help you tell great stories with your cinematography. Here's how. So basically, composition is literally how you compose or put together visual elements within your shot. And I think we all know the classic rules of composition, like the 180-degree rule, or if you don't know, look it up. But I think also all great directors develop their own visual language. So I encourage you, Victoria, and the rest of you to read some of these articles, look at the composition or the way things are placed in your favorite films, and then get out there and experiment and develop your own principles of composition. Maybe you'll even come back and do a post on No Film School about it. Another question on the boards came from Lorenzo Morgan Jr., who said that he's basically been reading a lot about filmmaking. He sees a lot of info about camera and audio equipment, but he rarely comes across professionals who speak on the importance of storyboarding. And so he asked us, are storyboards still important?
And if you ask the director of High Rise, Ben Wheatley, which I did recently, he told me that storyboarding is incredibly important. And in fact, he does it twice for his entire film, which results in over 1,000 drawings before shooting. But the catch is he doesn't bring the storyboards on set. He does this so that he can visualize the whole movie at least twice over. And it forces him to think about small things like how people enter and exit frames.
Yeah, I don't think any filmmaker would argue that the age of digital filmmaking or that new equipment has, you know, gotten rid of the importance of storyboarding. You know, it's sort of separate from equipment and it's separate from your script writing as well. It's like that step in between writing the script and using the equipment. And I think it can be critical for visualizing your film and for communicating that vision to everyone on your set. So I imagine that if you do some Googling, you will find lots of information online about storyboarding, and again, on our site as well. And, you know, there's new software out there these days. I know Adobe has some. And even just by using like a comic book software, for example, and taking photographs, you don't even need to know how to draw anymore. You can really use the computer to generate your storyboards. And
it's so much less about the artistic rendering of your film. And it's more about orienting yourself in your film's world and giving yourself a sense of the process of action in each scene, in each shot.
So yes to storyboards. They are still relevant, and I think they always will be. I would like to plug an event. I am speaking on a panel with Her Girl Friday and Film Fatales on Friday, June 3rd, 2016, with some very prolific documentary filmmakers, Judith Helfland, Ursula Lang, and Lynn True, and some of the folks from the Her Girl Friday organization. And we're talking about career sustainability in documentary filmmaking. So if you're in New York, please come by. It's at ThoughtWorks, New York City, 99 Madison Ave. It's free, and the doors are at 6. Discussion starts at 7. Hope to see you there. As always, thank you so much for joining us. You can listen to Indie Film Weekly every Thursday by subscribing on iTunes or finding us on SoundCloud or anywhere where podcasts are found. You can read a lot of the posts that we discussed here at nofilmschool.com. And I can be reached on Twitter at LizFilm. Emily is
E.L. Booter.
And we are at No Film School. Thanks so much. See you next week.
Thanks, everyone.